Welcome everybody to this session on social and psychological sciences. I'm Dominic Halsmer. I'll be moderating our session. And our first speaker this morning is associate professor of psychiatry at Yale. It's Sam Wilkinson. We go way back. We met Saturday on the walk through. But I'm really excited to hear his version of the evolutionary origin of the emotional rewarding nature of personal relationships. You got the lapel mic on?
I do.
Great.
All right.
I'm told to use this microphone, even though it's a small room. I think this is... So a couple months ago, I was driving in my car. I had two of my kids in the backseat, ages 10 and 8. And I needed to call my wife. Sometimes when I'm driving and I need to call someone, I avail myself of the artificial intelligence feature for iPhones. It's called Siri. I don't know if any of you have noticed that sometimes when you ask Siri to call someone and there's more than one number for the contact, Siri will sometimes say, which one? I don't remember why, or I was driving, I needed to call my wife, and instead of saying, call Sarah, I wanted to see, is Siri smart enough to figure out who my wife is? So I said, call my wife. Siri says, which one? I had to backtrack a little bit and tell my kids that I was not leading the double life. Artificial intelligence is remarkable. It's likely going to change the way our culture and economies work. I'm not going to talk about AI today. You're not in the wrong session. There's been a number of talks on that. I'm a professor of psychiatry at Yale, and I want to share briefly an experience I had when I was in medical school. I went to a religious undergraduate institution, and I had the fortune to attend Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. And within a month or so of getting there, I started to really struggle with what I was learning in school seemed to be at odds with the sense that I had, that most people had, that life has purpose and value and meaning. And what I said what I was learning in school was the theory of evolution. This is Charles Darwin, his most influential book, The Origin of Species, published in 1859. And I went through a period of several months of reading and studying and wrestling, meditating, praying, trying to figure out how this made sense. And it's hard for me to describe, but things, at least for me, really seemed to come together in a way that was beautiful. And I got answers that for me were very satisfying from both an intellectual and a spiritual perspective to some questions that I think are important. Among them, what is the purpose of life? Does life even have a purpose? What is at the heart of human nature? And by this, I mean, are humans ultimately selfish or altruistic? And also, what is at the root of human happiness? Now, this is a 20-minute talk. I don't have time to get into all these. I'm going to focus on this last one. What is at the root of human happiness? Around 2010, the Pew Foundation conducted a survey of young adults that was focused on this issue, asking young people, what do you think is going to make you happy? What are your life goals? So it turns out that, at least in 2010, about two-thirds of young people said that their most important life goal was to make money. Another sizable portion said that their most important life goal was to become famous. Now, I was practicing this talk with my family earlier last week. I couldn't understand why my teenage daughters kept getting furious that I couldn't remember the name of this person here. Maybe some of you know more about her than I do. Apparently, she's a big deal. So overall, about 75 to 80% of young people in this survey said their most important life goal was to make money or to become famous. Now, it turns out that with a little bit of nuance, those factors don't really have a whole lot to do with happiness and well-being. Let me turn to a study, which I think is one of the best studies to answer this question. In the 1930s, there was a physician at Harvard who said, we've been spending a lot of time and effort studying what makes people sick, But I think we need to spend time and effort studying what makes people well. So he started what has since become known as the Harvard Adult Development Study. He started by enrolling a couple hundred Harvard college students, and in time he added boys from some of the poorest neighborhoods of Boston to have some socioeconomic diversity. And then the key goal of the study was to figure out what are the factors that most lead to a good life, a good and a meaningful life. Now, over the years, the participants in the Harvard Adult Development Study have donated hundreds of their hours of time to the study. In the initial evaluation alone, they spent 8 hours in an interview with a psychiatrist. Now, I'm a psychiatrist, and that sounds like torture to me. They had extensive evaluations of their psychological and physical profiles. They completed the SAT. They interpreted ink blot tests. Now, over the course of the study, one of the longest acting directors, a guy named George Valen, Harvard psychiatrist, after the data was being parsed and collated and collected and organized, he concluded this: the only thing that really matters in life are your relationships to other people. Now, this is a finding that has been replicated many times in psychology. Now, I'm interested in the question as to why. Why is this the case? Why are relationships emotionally rewarding? I remember a conversation I had with a colleague and friend about this, and we were talking about different aspects. He said, well, maybe that's just how God made us. And I didn't disagree, but I told him I needed a more earthbound explanation. I couldn't really necessarily put that in an academic paper. Now, if you're like me and you think that evolution has something to do with the way that we developed and were created, maybe that has something to do with it. And I think this is part of the answer. Relationships have always served us relatively well. Our ancestors developed during a time of extreme unpredictability. Climate change is not necessarily a new thing. There was bad luck in hunting and so forth. Those groups that stayed together did better than those that didn't. And as a result, we have developed a psychological need to belong to groups that are bigger than ourselves. I think that's part of the answer. But another part has to do with what I would consider the most fundamental and relevant of biological relationships, which are the relationships between parents, especially mothers, and their children. A lot of this has to do with the work of one of my professional heroes, a psychiatrist named John Bowlby. He's a British psychiatrist who came of age professionally in the early 1900s. Now, when Bowlby was beginning his career, many of the now outdated theories of Sigmund Freud still held great sway. Among these were the notion that relationships weren't really that important. They were just a means to an end. The baby loved the mother because the mother gave the baby milk. The husband loved the wife because the wife gave him sex. It was a very transactional quid pro quo. There were even so-called mental health experts who said that parents should, too much of a relationship, too much love, would not be good for children. Let me share with you the advice of one of the leading experts at the time. The president of the American Psychological Association wrote a book in 1828. And this is the advice that he gave to parents and how they should treat their children. He said, never hug and kiss them. Never let them sit on your lap. If you must kiss them once on the forehead when they say goodnight, shake hands with them in the morning. Won't you remember that mother love is a dangerous instrument? An instrument which may inflict a never-healing wound, make infancy unhappy, adolescence a nightmare, and wreck your adult son or daughter's chances for marital happiness. I don't know if any of you have kids. Does this sound like good advice? It's kind of astounding to think that we considered this sound advice. There's an anecdote, by the way, of a woman who came up to this man after he gave a public lecture and said, thank goodness I had my children before I met you and that I had a chance to enjoy them. This, by the way, was heralded as a godsend to parents by a little-known magazine called The Atlantic. Now, Bowlby recognized that this was ridiculous, so he sought for further answers to understand the depth of complexity of human interactions. And in searching for answers, he studied babies. The babies both of humans, but also of animals. Let me share just a few interesting observations about the babies of humans and animals. I'm going to start with animals. So, a baby giraffe. The first thing a baby giraffe experiences upon being born is a 6-foot drop to the ground. So female giraffes give birth standing up. But within an hour, that baby giraffe can stand, walk around on its own, and feed on its own. This is remarkably self-sufficient compared to humans. If any of you are parents out there, I wonder, what would it be like if your kid could walk within an hour of being born, right? A baby calf whale can swim to the surface within moments of being born. Now humans, on the other hand, we are totally unable to walk, eat. We can't communicate or even fully sense the world when we are born. We are so immature when we are born that some scholars who study infant development refer to the first 3 to 6 months of life as the, quote, fourth trimester. Okay. But the slow rate of human development has its advantages. Okay, it allows us to be shaped by the environment more than any other creature. Okay, and Bowlby noticed this, and he reasoned that everything a baby can do, cry, coo, suck, smile, is in part meant to draw the parents close by and keep them attached. All right, this is evolutionarily adapted. This is from an evolutionary framework. This helps the baby survive. Otherwise, the baby would not be able to live. But the behaviors of the baby are just one side of the coin, okay? There must be a strong reciprocal attachment on the part of the parents. And fortunately, most of the time, Mother Nature cooperates. Anyone who's been a first-time parent can remember the deep feelings of love and affection that develop and that you experience upon seeing your first child smile, laugh, interact with you. Okay, the baby represents a huge biological and evolutionary investment, and of necessity engenders a strong sense of love. Let me share the words of a woman named Dorothy Day. She was a social activist and writer, not, I don't think, particularly religious, not conservative. This is what she says. She says, if I had written the greatest book, composed the greatest symphony, painted the most beautiful painting, or carved the most exquisite figure, I could not have felt the more exalted creator than I did when they placed my child in my arms. No human creature could receive or contain so vast a flood of love and joy as I felt after the birth of my first child. Again, many parents can relate to this, right? The birth of a child can induce within you a sense of love and joy. It's like there's another chamber in your heart you didn't know existed, okay? I think this points to a deep truth that family relationships represent the most powerful forms of love and affection that nature has created. This is the way that we are evolutionarily and psychologically engineered. This is how we were created. Now today, there is a raging debate in the popular culture about the value and even desirability of having children in society. To have kids or not to have kids, that is the question. This is essentially a peripheral battle in the culture wars. With headlines, this is a line from an opinion piece in the New York Times from a year ago, motherhood is a game no one wins. Now, certainly raising kids is an extraordinary challenge, and every parent has experiences of days of frustration, even heartache, but when researchers ask people what makes life meaningful, why you get up in the morning, most people point to family and children. A Pew Research Foundation study of about 5,000 adults, 2021, reported that parents were twice as likely to report that spending time caring for the children is very meaningful compared to spending time at work. Another Pew Research Foundation study of 17,000 adults internationally asked people to list in an open-ended question what you find most meaningful and rewarding in life. After tallying, coding up all the answers, the most common reason and thing that was motivating and meaningful was family and children. Now, I hasten to point out that I think the rewarding nature of being a parent is fundamentally and inextricably linked to the demanding nature of being a parent, okay? The deep love that parents feel helps compensate for the challenges that parenting requires. Remember, we talked about how our children are so helpless when they are born, and we love them because of it. But also, they're so helpless, and that makes them very difficult. So let me try to drive this home with a quasi-serious thought experiment. Try to imagine what our social lives would be like if we were seahorses. Now, seahorses are very interesting creatures. One of the ways that many species of seahorses are interesting is that it's the males who get pregnant and give birth. Now, if we were like that, there would probably be some different parental leave policies, right? Another interesting thing about seahorses is that when the offspring are born, there's essentially no parental attachment. The male father seahorse gives birth and says, goodbye, good luck, hope you make it, don't get eaten, pass on my genes. Now, no human being knows exactly what it's like to be a seahorse, but it's a good bet that if we didn't have a need to have that deep attachment and nurture for our children, we wouldn't have much of a sense of love for our kids or for anyone for that matter. And I think this, to me at least, reveals maybe an unexpected truth on an almost spiritual level that you can't have deep love without compelling sacrifice. Let me try to wrap up where I began with Charles Darwin, The Origin of Species. So after hundreds of pages of detailing the intricate mechanisms of evolution and natural selection, Darwin ends his book with these memorable words. There's grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one. And in a second edition, he inserted three interesting words to the sentence so that it read, there's grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one. Now, whether he inserted these words out of, at the time, genuine belief or because he felt his Lord's and Christian audience needed to hear it as anyone's guess. He later wrote that he regretted doing so. But in my view, at least, there really is grandeur in this view of life. And to recognize it, I note that family relationships represent the most powerful forms of love that nature has created. This is how we are psychologically and evolutionarily engineered. If God has created us such that we are to multiply and replenish the earth and have joy in our posterity, I think it's no wonder that a process such as evolution was used. Thank you very much.
Would you like to ask some questions? Yes, I.
Thanks, Anna. That's a great talk.
Thank you.
Do you want the microphone?
I'll repeat the question.
Oh,
so,
or I could yell.
Yeah, either way.
So the other thing about human evolution, which I think proceeds from love of parents and children, is love between siblings, to cousins, and extending out from the original nuclear family, which is great. And you get a cohesion of a larger group beyond the family, and eventually you have a tribe. And all of that makes perfect sense, evolutionarily speaking, because a tribe does better than just individuals or even small families. But then we have a problem, which we now see today, and that is tribalism.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is, it goes right to your last statement about the Creator. Mm-hmm. When Jesus came, he told us, you know, there's no Greek or Jew, et cetera, et cetera. We're all one in Jesus Christ. Actually, Paul told us that, but, you know, that's part of Christianity. So my question is, how do we get, given evolutionary pressures, which we see so strongly today, to be tribal, how do we get to the Christian vision that's basically anti-tribalism and, in a way, anti-evolutionary?
Yeah, so what you referred to, the question is, how do we overcome tribalism?
That's it.
So I'll give you the ultimate answer in 30 seconds. I'm just kidding. It's obviously a complicated endeavor. I think what is at the heart of this is a psychological phenomenon referred to as in-group and out-group bias. Okay, so we tend to treat others that we see as part of our group preferentially compared to those outside of our group, and that's part of human nature. It's an artifact of evolution, I think. So that's the bad news about it. The good news is that the definition of a group is quite flexible, okay? And so there's that flexibility there. The psychological literature suggests, well, I think the part of the answer to this is to emphasize, one, what we have in common, our shared humanity, and then the trying to have a superordinate goal, a goal that matters to as many members of the group as possible. The psychological literature suggests that that is what helps us kind of draw a circle around all of humanity, and that we're all inside of it. So, but it's not easy, right? There are a lot of forces, corporate and otherwise, that have a monetary stake in dividing people because it gets likes, or not really likes, but hates, and it drives the algorithms, right, of social media and such. So, but again, the good news is that the definition of a group is quite flexible. Okay, let's go. No, you're the moderator.
Do you see a role between our diet and the love that we have for one another, evolutionarily?
I haven't looked into that, so I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry. Maybe you can enlighten me on it. It'd be interesting to look into.
Great talk, Sam. Thank you. I'm just thinking about the attachment literature, and a lot of it looking at time spent together and positive interactions in relation to negative interactions. I'm wondering if you think there's maybe something special about familial relationships that increases love more than if you would have, say, that same level of interaction with, say, an adopted child, and how maybe those different views might affect our love for God, or, as Cy brought up, maybe love for outgroup members.
Yeah, so I think the attachment theory, which is, John Bowlby, that was his main thing, I think it's very related to kin selection. And there is an intrinsic affinity that you have for people who are related to you, if you know that they're related to you. Adoption is a complicated topic. It's a wonderful thing to adopt, but it's hard. I mean, when a child is adopted, almost always that means that child was not wanted or able to be cared for by their biological parents. And a lot of times, the biological mothers adopted kids, they show up late for pregnancy, they may have drug or alcohol problems. And so, you just look at adopted children, they tend to struggle more than biological children. And not necessarily because your adopted parents treat them worse, but because they've started out with a bit of a disadvantage. So, it's an incredibly admirable thing to do when adopted parents go through that process. How does that relate? I think and part of what we are asked to do by the Savior and the Scriptures is to sometimes go against our nature. I don't think human nature is a single monolithic thing. I think we have different capacities within us, and part of what the commandments compel us to do is to put aside one aspect of our natures and to listen to and obey another part of our nature. So the kinship, which is often a good thing, sometimes can be a negative. Your adopted parent, you have to overcome that. And even if this child does not have biological ties to you, treat him or her as best as possible. Hopefully, I gave you some semblance of an answer to your question.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, Sam. I fully agree and appreciate your very good articulation of the importance of these relationships. But you also showed clearly how, at least from giraffes and whales and seahorses,
yeah.
that other species don't have that same degree of dependence on that relationship. The implication could be that in the deep human ancestral past, this bonding relationship wasn't that strong. Do you have any ideas of how and why evolutionary processes could have brought us to our current state?
Yeah, there's a lot of ideas. No one knows exactly for sure because no one was there when it happened. Mm-hmm. But I think it may have had something to do with, okay, the best thinking is that our ancestors became bipedal 5 million years ago. As that happened, at the same time, there was growing pressure for increased intelligence, adaptability, which means increased brain size. You could only fit a certain size brain through the hips of a bipedal woman, and so nature's solution was to make the brain the same size at birth, but allow a prolonged maturation process after birth. This, of course, is what made the babies born very, very premature. At that point, the woman could not physically care for the baby alone, and she literally could not provide enough calories in the day. She needed help. The most important, the person who had the most at stake evolutionarily was the father, and this may be related to our ability, our capacity for pair bonding, and the fact that, you know, We do have the capacity to pair bond for long, you know, monogamy and so forth. We unfortunately have remnants of a different mating strategy within us, which we're again asked to overcome through commandments and other things. But I think that may have had something to do with it.
Thank you.
One more question.
One more quick question.
So just back to Dorothy Day. She was very faithful Catholic.
Oh, I'm sorry.
She came back to her faith through having her daughter.
Okay.
And she just felt this incredible sense of thankfulness, and she didn't know where to direct it. She just figured she had to direct it to God.
Yeah.
And that brought her back. But she also said of her daughter, because her husband, her boyfriend, was not involved in the parenting. And she also said, because she was like stuck solo parenting this newborn, and she said, I thought I had freedom before, but in having my daughter, now I know what freedom is.
That's interesting.
Really interesting, version of what freedom is about in that situation.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize. My sense was when she wrote that, she wasn't particularly involved, or maybe I'm wrong about that, but this brought her back, is that what you
said? Yes. So she was raised Catholic, lost her faith, and having her child.
I got it. Which is not necessarily a common, for a lot of adults, 30s or so, having a child, it's like, oh, maybe I should go back to church.
Well, thank you, Sam.
Yeah.